We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. In previous episodes, we've briefly touched upon the colony of Florida, as well as the status of African Americans in the Declaration of Independence itself. We talked a little bit about the status of African Americans in the colonies. And today what we're going to do is explore these issues further. So we're going to talk about the complicated and diverse history of Florida. It changed hands so many times. It has so many influences. And we're going to talk a little bit about how African Americans were actually pretty important in Florida during the American Revolution. And my expert guest today is Professor Jane Landers. Jane is Gertrude Conaway Vanderbilt Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and the director of the Slave Society's Digital Archive, which is the largest database for the history of African and indigenous people in the Atlantic world. And it's free to access. There will be links in the show notes. Professor Landers is also a prolific author. She has written Atlantic Creoles in the Age of Revolutions, as well as the book Black Society in Spanish Florida. And those links will also be in the show notes. So, Professor Landers, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
You started by reading those famous lines from the Declaration of Independence. So why did you choose those to talk about Spanish Florida, Florida, and African Americans in Florida?
Well, it seems pretty obvious that they were never considering, when they wrote those beautiful lines, African Americans as people who deserved these rights. And I grew up in a multicultural society in the Caribbean. I became interested in inequality and race. I ended up doing doctoral work on Spanish Florida, practically by accident. But amazing history comes out of those documents that people had not been exploring. And one of the evidence of that is this great interest in the 1619 Project, which is a wonderful project for everything north of Jamestown and for everything Anglo, is that the whole half of our southern tier of our country, from Florida to California, had a different history.
And I'm just going to pause right there. Explain just to our audience what the 1619 Project was again.
A wonderful project called 1619 explored what people believe is the first landing of Africans in our country in Jamestown in 1619. But that ignores several centuries of African history in our country below the Anglo colonies, and those were the Spanish half of our country from Florida to California, where a totally different system of society, of law, of custom, of religion held.
So what we're trying to do in your approach here is to balance that history. We have, and I think it's fair to say, in much of the general public's understanding of African American history, and generally the history of the U.S., is very much that Anglo history. And we often do forget, or at least it's marginalized or minimalized, what was happening in Florida, for example, or in what is now Texas, New Mexico. In other words, the entire Spanish history of the United States now. I think that's fascinating. Now, Jane, another question, not to start conflicts here, but there is that famous passage, of course, that Jefferson wrote in the Declaration condemning slavery, which was obviously deleted. Other historians say this is clear evidence that the impulse to include African Americans and maybe indigenous people and Creoles as well in that line, and women, all men are created equal, shows that that intent was already there. So how do you interpret that, and what would you just say to historians who kind of have a different perspective?
Thomas Jefferson actually countered his own argument when, as Secretary of State, in 1790, he basically threatened Spain that if they wanted to remain on amicable terms, they would remove the religious sanctuary policy that they had had in effect from at least 1687, when I first locate runaway enslaved people from Carolina, an Anglo colony that had actually settled itself in what Spain considered their own territory. And I found men with their wives and nursing babies escaping in canoes across the first, what I call, Underground Railroad South into Spanish Florida, where centuries-long precedents required them to receive people seeking what they called the true faith, meaning Catholicism. And so I term that religious sanctuary they are giving them, and it was that. I mean, I don't mean to suggest it was not heartfelt, but it was also very strategic in its application, because the more enslaved people who ran away from Anglo colonies to the north and were received into Spanish Florida, the weaker the Anglo colonies became for loss of labor, etc., and the stronger the Spanish. And who would be more faithful and grateful to the Spanish government and fight for its maintenance than those who had received religious sanctuary?
One thing that just confused me here was that Spanish Florida was still Spanish Florida in 1790. I thought after the end of the Seven Years' War, there was a transfer of Florida from Spain to Britain.
There is. And then in 1784, Spain recovers Florida, trading it basically for Cuba and the Philippines that had been taken by Anglos, and they were ready to give up Florida, which was not as successful as Havana, which was, very important colony for them.
So from the end of the Seven Years' War, 1763, to 1784.
That's right.
Florida, or the territory of Florida, is part of the British Empire. And then it goes back to Spain from 84 until when?
1784 to 1821.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well, we're doing a lot of history, and we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves because we wanted to start with some of the origin stories here. But I think it's important for our listeners right now to remember some of the complexity that Professor Landers just shared with us, which is that there was a European legal culture, a European political culture from Spain that was filtering throughout Florida. And Florida has such a fascinating, unique history because it changed hands several times. It has these competing groups of people who live there with all sorts of really interesting, different types of religious beliefs, political expectations, and all this stuff. And we're going to explore all that today. But now we're going to go back to the start. Let's start talking about the first main thing that we need to discuss today, which is the origins of Florida. So, Jane, take me through several hundred years of Florida history, please.
Sure, Andy. Well, the first European city in what is today our country was established in 1565, and that is San Agustin de la Nueva Florida, established in what we call today just regular Florida, by a very important Spanish admiral, Pedro Menéndez de Áviles, who was given a contract to establish Spain in North America, and St. Augustine was his first settlement. He tries a second settlement a little bit farther north, also in Santa Elena, which was actually ruined by indigenous rebellion, and we're reduced back to St. Augustine as the only Spanish town that he established. In that settlement came enslaved Africans, but also there were always people who were of African descent who were also free in all of the Spanish world. And Spain, which was a small population of people, had to try to settle an empire that went from, Spain to the Philippines, from Chile to South Carolina, and they needed every hand. And that would mean opportunities for people who could establish themselves in these colonies of whatever ancestry, and Africans served Spain and its expansion around the world for hundreds of years before we ever get an Anglo settlement in what became South Carolina, which was 1670.
So what percentage, roughly, of the Spanish Africans were enslaved people, and how, what percentage were free? Were they all enslaved? I mean, how did that entire ecosystem of Africans in say, Florida work in the Spanish period?
Well, Africans, I don't think there's any particular percentage that we could give you on that, because they would get contracts for 100 enslaved Africans could go with them to build an establishment somewhere, whatever colony. But how many actually made it is very unclear. But free people of color are everywhere in these expeditions, including the very first expeditions across our country, 1513, illiterate African who had come from Spain via Portugal, comes with our first explorations of the New World in our country, and actually leaves an account of his services. Juan Garrido left a long document called Méritos y Servicios, his merits and services to the Spanish crown. And this was part of that older system that you talked about, whereby a monarch, a good monarch, was supposed to take care of all its subjects and reward them for services. They, on the other hand, were supposed to be loyal subjects and help advance Catholicism in the New World and establishment of the Roman legal system in the New World that Spain brought with it. And this agreement happens all over Spain's colonial era. So we can find the same law being practiced in Manila as being practiced in San Agustin, as being practiced in La Habana. It's the same law, it's the same social system of welcoming enslaved people into the fold, offering them various ways, if they were enslaved, to become free, including manumission by their owner, manumission by the state for good service, self-purchase. They could make a deal through the courts for their actual price and make down payments, and as soon as they finished the obligation of the payment, they were free and entered the society just like anybody else. So these are the ways Spain was able to have the manpower in this vast empire it created to actually make it work for several centuries before England contested, at least in our country.
That's really interesting. So when you were talking about all men being created equal at the very start, what I'm hearing with all of this discussion about freeing enslaved people is that the Spanish imperial legal system actually embodied the concept that all men were created equal more than the Anglo legal system. Would that be accurate?
I think it would, and I had not really considered it that way, but they believed that slavery was against actual norms, and that you became an enslaved person by some crime, some debt, all of these sorts of issues could make you an enslaved person, including if you were sold on the African coast to somebody else and you came into the Americas as an enslaved person. All of these things. So it's not as if they did not have enslaved people. They did, but they considered slavery against the norm. And instead, liberty was the right of everybody. And as you could prove yourself some way and become a good Christian and a good service to the crown or to your owner, those were many of the ways you could become a free person. So slavery is the aberration in their system. It's not that it doesn't exist. One of the considerations is that American system of slavery, based on the old Anglo system of slavery, was considering people as chattel, as property, to be bought and sold. Families could be separated. Enslaved people could be, in some cases, murdered, and owners might get away with it. In the Spanish or Iberian system, they're always human, There were prohibitions against maltreatment. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but there are prohibitions, and if somebody wanted to contest it, they could take it through the courts and often win. There were also prohibitions against separating families, and I have seen enslaved people go to court and win it in Florida. So on the church would then come in on the side of the enslaved person and go through the secular law. There's also religious law to be considered. And in these ways, Africans learned very quickly, as any of us would, what are the routes out of slavery? How can we make this system work? Where is our best option? Is it running to the Spanish settlements to the south? Is it running to the indigenous villages, which some did instead? What is our best option? We know chattel slavery in this Anglo plantation that's going to work us to death is not our best option.
We learned in previous episodes about, say, the French-Canadian legal environment, that there were different concepts of freedom. And of course, when the Continental Congress was sending its letters to French Canadians saying, you guys have no idea what freedom is, this is what it is. Well, and they were like, don't tell us what it means to be a free person. We don't care about this taxation without representation concept or some of these other concepts of freedom. I'm making this connection now to Florida and the Spanish political legal ideologies or cultures. They had a notion of human liberty that was quite different from the Anglo model. Black people should be free. Like, people should be free. But since they're all subject of a king and subject to the hierarchies of the Catholic Church, they didn't necessarily think freedom meant, and also they should have the right to representation in Congress. You know, so there are just these different contested concepts of freedom in each of these French, Spanish, and Anglo colonies.
That's right. They actually, of course, had a monarchy. And so their concept of government was a monarchical system in which, in the ideal, and I always warn my classes, law does not equal practice. Ideals are something you aspire to, you may not reach. At least in the Spanish ideal, a monarch was supposed to be a good monarch, and there were corporate systems of societal organization. The king at the top, appointed by God, underneath him would be nobles, etc. Beneath nobles were religious figures as well. Beneath that, the society at large, which included enslaved people. And a good monarch owed all of his subjects, from the mightiest to the lowest, good government. It meant that he owed them all sorts of relief, and they owed him service and loyalty. And it's an ideal, as I warn my classes, ideals are aspired to, but they may not be reached. Law does not equal practice. All of that being said, this system believed that slavery was against the law of nature and reason, and moving towards the ideal would be moving people to freedom, and moving them also into the Catholic faith would be the Spanish model. And so this is from the origins of supposed, you know, discovery of a new world. Christopher Columbus made the pitch to Queen Isabella that he would bring to the fold the sheep that hadn't been brought in yet. And it was always part of the expansion of Spanish Empire. The promise was to incorporate everybody into the Spanish faith. So it becomes what I called religious sanctuary, rather than just a legal principle as well. There's a religious law and there's a secular law, and both of them operated towards freedom. And the other way that this system is so much different than the Anglo system, in the Anglo world, you're supposed to be a rugged individual and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But in this world, you're part of many overlapping circles of societal connection. So you are part of this kingdom. You are part of this Catholic Church. You are part of this military infrastructure. You are part of this little town. You are part of this religious brotherhood. You are part of this church. All of these ways in which people of multiple races could be incorporated together. And those systems were more important than racial difference in an Iberian system which had long been multiracial, which had had Africans living in Lisbon and Sevilla and all of these places for centuries before Columbus heads out. So he's bringing with him, even if for cynical reasons perhaps on his part, but I would say he actually was a good Catholic, having at one point adopted the name Christopherens, which is, you know, bearer of Christ. So I always try to tell my classes as well that we live in a secular age, and it's easy to believe that people were not so faithful as they probably were.
That's really interesting. Okay, so let's now move on in our history. We had a little bit of a detour here, but learned a lot. We were talking about the origins of the first colony in, or the first city, St. Augustine. And so, you know, we got to slowly start getting to, I think, the first major conflict, which is the start of the Seven Years' War in the 1750s. So from 1581, was it? When was Augustine founded?
No, it's 1565.
1565, St. Augustine is founded.
Yes.
How do we get from there to, say, the Seven Years' War? What are the next sort of important
things to remember?
All right,
there's a lot that goes between them.
I know there's a lot.
One of the things is that England never believed that Columbus had brought Spain the whole title to the whole world. And, you know, I pick it up with my classes basically in the Elizabethan period when she begins hiring her favorite pirates, basically, Sir Francis Drake and others, to attack Spanish colonies, and he burns St. Augustine. So they had to rebuild multiple times from English attacks, from French attacks, Protestant attacks of any sort. And they do over and over again. And why is St. Augustine critical to the Spanish Empire? No big treasures, no big indigenous populations like Mexico or Peru would have for them. It's location, location, location. On the route of the silver fleets back home from Mexico and Peru up the Atlantic to take a right and go to Spain. And they put St. Augustine right there for that reason. And they develop big forts there. And their military occupation of Florida is important.
Okay, so for all those years, we have the trade, the silver trade going from Central and South America back to Spain. And is there any conflict besides, sort of, I think what I'm thinking about is land conflict between whatever the northern border is of the Spanish colony of Florida and, I would guess, Georgia.
Yes, there are very big conflicts. As soon as Charleston is established, Spain starts sending militia groups, small ones, of indigenous people and Africans to attack their settlements. And so there's a long history of contestation across the southeast for control between what the Spaniards would consider interlopers, the Anglos in Charleston, and later another interloper would be General James Oglethorpe, who establishes Georgia. That becomes another one. There are some Scots who establish Darien, and the Spaniards send indigenous and African people, the ones most willing to risk it, to attack those settlements. And so there's a long, long history of military confrontation and contestation in all of these areas. And before we get to the Seven Years' War, there's the War of Jenkins Ear, which actually breaks out in 1739, a global war caused by the alleged attack of an Englishman where a Spanish corsair cut off his ear, and Robert Jenkins takes his ear back to Parliament and shows it off as an insult to the English nation by the Spanish. It launches the War of Jenkins Ear, which is a global war. And this is Spain's actual success, which was not expected, in Spanish Florida and also in Cartagena. The English thought they would wipe out all these small settlements around Puerto Bello or Panama, everywhere, Santo Domingo again, and they don't make it in Florida. They are held back because of the assistance of these free people of color who have been welcomed with religious sanctuary and established the first free black town in what is today the United States in St. Augustine, or just north of it, and they called it Gracia Real de Santa Teresa de Mose. So the Battle of Bloody Mose is where Oglethorpe brings with him Scots and Englishmen and Irish and indigenous and African people to try to kick the Spanish out of Florida once and for all, as they tried to do multiple times. And in this case, the Mose people help repel the English, and Oglethorpe and the Scotch people and the English people and the Indians and the Africans are driven back, and Spain retains Florida again through contestation.
You've been talking about it as a contested territory, and I think that's really the important point that we've been making since the start, that Florida is contested and diverse. One thing we haven't touched on, so before we get to the Seven Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War, is Indians or indigenous people. Can you just maybe make one or two comments about the general state of relations between the indigenous people and the Spanish crown?
Right. Well, the indigenous people are people you are also trying to bring into the fold and convert to Catholicism. So Spaniards would have considered indigenous practices, religious practices, to be heresy. They only believe the true faith is Catholicism. And so from the beginning, from Columbus forward, they are trying to also convert indigenous people and bring them into the faith. And if they do come into the faith, they are welcomed also, and their leadership of their own communities is recognized as the natural lords of that place. They are also, like good Spaniards, supposed to provide military defense and support and tribute and so on, but they are incorporated, much like Africans would be. And so this was always part of the Spanish effort with the indigenous. Now, do they have conflicts with indigenous nations? Yes, but they would not be as abusive in, for instance, their trade relationships as the Anglos worked out to be. So there's another even earlier war that we didn't talk about, the Yamasee War, when the Yamasee Indians of South Carolina allow runaway enslaved Africans to join them in fighting the English. So they too thought the English were the most abusive system. And in fact, the leader of the community that I studied for so many years, Mose, that we talked about, has run with the Yamasee and has fought with them before coming into Spanish Florida with them. And so indigenous chiefs incorporated Africans in the Yamasee War, just as the Spanish would later.
Really interesting. Okay, so let's get now to the French and Indian or Seven Years' War. And we've learned a lot about already what was going on in the Anglo colonies in France, but not so much about the role of Spain and Florida in the Seven Years' War. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about that? What's going on in Florida?
Well, Spanish Florida by the 1750s is a weaker settlement than it had been earlier due to these multiple attacks by Englishmen and due to its own decaying economy. Silver output had dropped dramatically in the 17th century. They called it the 17th century depression. So silver is down. Imperial competition is up. The need to build defenses is costly. All of this has reduced Spain's power in the world from earlier centuries. And so by the 1750s, at least Florida is a much weakened colony. So when this war breaks out, they are barely able to hang on against, you know, continued attacks. And finally, they had built a great fortress in St. Augustine that tourists love to go to today, the Castillo de San Marcos. It was never defeated militarily because it's built of coquina, which just absorbs those cannonballs. But treaties, European treaties, are what hand Florida over finally to the Anglos. And it will agree to these kinds of changes because, as I mentioned earlier, the English had seized Havana in 1762 in these wars, and Havana was much more important to the Spanish Empire than was San Agustin. And so in a treaty, they are betrayed in a sense by Spain because they are told, we'll take Havana over St. Augustine. So Spain must face the consequences and evacuate Spanish Florida. And they evacuate primarily to Cuba, although some are also going to Mexico. And because indigenous people and Africans were now part of their world, part of their empire, they must offer not just Spanish people a new home in Cuba, but they must offer a new home in Cuba to indigenous people and African people as well. And I have tracked this exodus or this exile to Cuba in 1763. We have records on which ships took which people and where they went in Cuba. And the Spanish crown relocates them. And just as it would relocate a Spanish subject, it will offer subsidies, support until they can get back on their feet, land, military service, all of these sorts of things. So for 20 years, the free people of color and the indigenous people who left with the Spaniards survive in Cuba. When another treaty turns Florida back into Spanish colony in 1784, the same principles that operated before will operate in the Spanish Florida that is established in 1784. Until 1821, when another treaty hands Florida over to the new American government.
Interesting. Just some follow-up questions here. One is roughly the number of people we're talking about who are refugees, essentially, who are resettled elsewhere outside of Florida after the Seven Years' War.
Several thousand, and numbers are a little bit, uncertain, but you can track how many went on which ships, where they went, where they landed. You will find individuals helping with that. Sometimes people who had been part of their social networks would speak up for them and support them in other ways. The church would help as well. And so it's an exile that is difficult, certainly hard to reestablish themselves in a brand new setting, but at least they do. And they usually, the people that I track from that exodus, remain in Cuba.
So another question is, it seems like Africans, black people, knowing what type of system was prevalent, chattel slavery in the Anglo colonies, obviously would have a good incentive to leave, preferring to be under a king who believed in some sort of basic rights of freedom for his subjects. But what about indigenous people? Were they just like, well, this is our ancestral lands. We don't care if it's a British king or a French king or a Spanish king or any other king. We're here.
Well, that's a wonderful question. And the answer is that it's very complex because certain indigenous groups also recognize that they can play one European power against another and go for their best option. So some will stay with the Anglos, but unfortunately, many of the English indigenous traders who had been responsible for expanding the frontier and bringing trade goods in and taking deer hides out were abusive. And so there's often at least some understanding that you might get a better deal from either the Spanish or the French, but the Spanish are the ones that I track. And there is a diaspora of early indigenous populations, too, through all this European contact. The first problem when we get Columbus into the New World is introducing diseases to which indigenous populations had never been exposed. So you go through this population wipeout, basically, in many areas, and a slow recovery. Then you bring in Europeans who are going to abuse your villages. Then you, find another option and you decide to head south. But many of the mission systems that were built for indigenous people along the southeastern coast are attacked and destroyed by Anglos as well. And so people are coming into Florida, indigenous refugees, and being resettled in new indigenous villages on the outskirts of St. Augustine. That would be what I consider the principal reason and the model for establishing MOSE, my free African town. They already had indigenous villages ruled by their own people who would vow to be loyal and provide tribute or service. And MOSE is an example of basically the same kind of formula. Recognize the Lord, the most important African among those refugees. Let him run the settlement. As long as he's Catholic and as long as he defends, he's in control of that village because they can't control everybody on the frontier. So you have to incorporate loyalty and let them run their own settlements.
Right. And in that respect, we do see, I would say, similarities between the British Anglo colonies and here. The people who chose a life and to have a future in the colonies wanted a good deal of independence, right?
That's
and they
right.
didn't like having, they didn't mind being subject to Parliament's laws or other, but they did want their own good deal of independence. And I just think that might be human nature. Okay, but I want to go now to the end of the Seven Years' War. So 1763. Spain loses control of Florida. You talked about the refugees leaving. And I remember from a previous episode, I think I'm right, the land that was promised to many of the Anglo soldiers west of the Appalachians because of the proclamation of 1763 by King George, saying, no, that land west of the Appalachians that you were supposed to be fighting for is now Indian country. We're going to give you all this land in mosquito-infested Florida instead. So is that the start of the Anglo movement to Florida, or did I get that wrong?
No, there's actually always been this Anglo push to take Florida. And yes, it wasn't a great environment. It's hot. It's got mosquitoes and so on and so forth. But planters always thought that they might develop some kind of a wonderful economy there like they had in South Carolina or they had in Georgia. And in that period, 1763 to 1784, many South Carolinian planters moved their operations into what now became British Florida, including about 9,000 slaves we estimate they brought in from Carolina. And they also are introducing new Africans into Florida from places like the Gambia River, Fort James, where Oswald, one of the signers of our Declaration of Independence, and Henry Lawrence, a signer of our Declaration of Independence, and Oswald, a slave trader, have a great deal going, they think, of bringing in all new Africans into British Florida. So we have a whole new set of African introductions during the British period because they think they've got Florida for good now and it's worth investing in and it's worth creating new plantations and moving your model, your plantation model, southward. And the plantation model is the worst you could labor under. If you were under a Spanish system where there were no plantations initially, you'd be a cowboy or you'd be a timberman or you'd be some other form of labor, but not the sunrise to sunset horrible labor that plantation sugar or cotton would be. But this is what the English thought they would introduce during their acquisition of Florida in 1763.
So putting this history together, there was a deep and long tradition of free black people in Florida that ended and a new generation or new group of enslaved Africans was introduced, kind of wiping out that history of free African
Right.
Free Africans in Florida. Really important that we all recognize that, I think. Okay, so let's now just get to there must have been some remaining free Africans in Florida, because if it's time now to get to the American Revolution, maybe we want to start telling that story of Florida's role in the American Revolution.
Well, actually, the irony here is that Spain assists Florida, or assists the U.S. patriots and the Americans in actually acquiring Florida. So in 1777, we have Spanish militias from Cuba coming into Florida to assist the Americans in the War of Independence. And all those battles happen around Pensacola, Florida, not in St. Augustine, but westward in Pensacola. So some of the free people of African descent that had acquired militia standing and freedom and property and wealth even in Cuba form part of the Spanish troops that are sent in to help the Americans win their independence in the southern tier again. So it's an interesting flip-flop on all these politics that free people of color actually help the Americans win their independence, the Americans who are not going to give them the same freedoms.
That's so interesting. Can you just tell me a little bit more about this?
Yes. In that Atlantic Creole's book that I mentioned, one of the groups that I talk about are free black militias like this, who are involved in coming with Spain's troops into the southern tier of our country and helping fight for the freedom of the Americans from England. And some of those are very famous characters who later will have some tragic endings. One of the most important was a figure named Aponte, who was one of the heroes in Pensacola and later tries to bring the end of slavery in Cuba and is executed in Cuba. So again, it's never a clear path.
What were their motivations? Why would they do this? Why would they leave Havana and go support the Americans? Was it just an order by the king? And so they did it, or did they have their own interests?
No, when they came, you know, they're geopolitically literate, as I say. They know what's going on, but their king is certainly going to try to stop the expansion of the U.S. ideas into what had been the southern tier of their country. You're going to see Africans helping, you know, weirdly enough, helping Andy Jackson in Louisiana, because if there had been this model of Spanish Louisiana, free black militias there, and he talks about them as if they're his brothers in an ironic sense, because later he'll come in and abuse them in the Seminole Wars.
Okay, well, there is a lot there, but now we're getting into the 19th century. Okay, so Jane, how do we want to now end our story of Florida for today chronologically? We've gone through the Seven Years' War. We've gone now a little bit through the Declaration of Independence and the role that free black people from Spain, free black militias, played on the southern front of the war for independence. So why don't you just try to get us through those years quickly until Spain does become, I'm sorry, until Florida becomes a state.
All right. Well, in the last years of what was Spanish Florida, those are the post-American independence years, 1784 to 1821. Many of the same contestations that I'm talking about continue. So European treaties don't always make a lot of difference in terms of the long history. Things flip-flop back and forth, and Florida always talks about itself under five flags, how many different, rules of law it had. But I sort of think also that Thomas Jefferson and our famous independence figures, as he goes on to represent Florida as Secretary of State in the 1790s, American expansionism and Manifest Destiny that we read about as simply a Western movement really begins in Florida, because they are determined to get everybody who had these concepts of freedom out of Florida so that they could establish a plantation economy eventually from the whole southern tier that they could control. And so American expansionism, Manifest Destiny, all of these things are going to have an import in Florida that we never recognize. And meanwhile, the free people of the second Spanish period, we called it 1784 to 1821, get evacuated by their Spanish government again to Cuba and to Mexico with the same privileges and rights that they always had for centuries from the 16th century forward. And they are given subsidies and lands and so on again in Spanish territory. So they continue their ideas about a different system. Although I will add as a kind of a little interesting tidbit at the end, some of the free African militias who served with the United States in the Wars of Independence in Pensacola have adopted some of those ideas. And so I find in Cuba in 1812, some of the African intellectuals talking about constitutions rather than monarchies. And I found one wonderful image in the wonderful Cuban collections at the University of Miami of a newspaper in which a publisher was trying to teach people of African descent their rights and was going to publish the new liberal constitution Spain adopted in 1812. And there's an image of a free black man with his hand in the air saying, "Constitution or death."
That's a wonderful image to end. For me, my big takeaway from the conversation today, and I learned so much from you, is that the concepts of political freedom and political rights cross-pollinated, and there were different concepts of freedom and different concepts of what it meant to be a citizen and different concepts from different traditions. And it wasn't just the Anglo tradition, which I would say is dominant now, that sort of overcame everything else, but those two systems actually are quite very much a hybrid system. And that last image you gave us, I think, really shows that perfectly. A free black man in Havana wanting an American-style democracy and constitution. Jane Landers, we're reaching the end. I ask all my guests, looking at, now you're an American citizen, a historian, an expert in Florida, Latin, Creole histories, slavery in the Atlantic world. When you look back at those words that you read at the beginning, what do you think? All men are created equal.
Well, you know, you can't help but think they only mean white men. They do not mean indigenous people or people of African descent, or as your earlier speaker said, nor women. And so there's a certain irony in the way we perceive freedom in the United States when centuries earlier, what we would consider an old-fashioned monarchical system actually implemented it for all of those categories.
Professor Jane Landers, thank you very much.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americancentrum.de. Thanks for listening.